Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, here we are, the day before the day of. Stocks were tame, credit keeps easing, but Detroit is doing worse than ever. Factories are slowing, and banks are lining up to get some bailout money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 3rd of November today. Great to have you with us. You know, there are many bad places to be in this economy. Not too many of them, though, worse than Detroit. The major car makers announced October sales today. I'll just say they were the worst in 25 years and leave it at that. On the small matter of the credit markets, there are some signs of improvement in some of the indicators we like to keep an eye on. But you'd really never know it to judge by what banks are doing. The Federal Reserve reported today that bank lending has actually tightened since the bailout plan was passed. You know, back a month ago when the Feds first unveiled their plan to use some of that bailout money to buy stakes in U.S. banks, it didn't go over too well. A lot of the people running them thought that taking government money would be seen as a sign of weakness. Well, not anymore. As Marketplace's Steve Henn reports from Washington, the new fear is being left out.
Hunt Burke is a bank president, but he eats lunch just like the rest of us.
I had some delicious drunken noodles, but I'm not drunken.
Burke prides himself on running a safe, sober family bank.
My great-great-grandfather started the bank in 1852.
Burke and Herbert Bank is the oldest in Virginia, and when the feds first proposed buying up stock in banks caught up in the mortgage crisis, Hunt Burke had a strong, immediate reaction.
Definitely not interested. We have capital, we have liquidity.
But recently a friend and banking consultant has convinced Burke to keep his options open.
And the only reason that we've had the second thought is in case we had in the back of our minds to purchase another bank, this would be a cheap source of capital.
Never mind that the congressional authors of the bailout say the money has to be used for loans. Banking consultants and attorneys are busy selling their own bailout ideas. Charles Gabriel is managing director at Capital Alpha Partners. He says their efforts have started a stampede.
Thousands of banks all marching on Washington, try to get into queue.
But there's less than $125 billion for cash infusions left, and insurance companies want a piece too.
It doesn't look like a lot of money when basically every bank has woken up in the last week and has decided that it needs to, you know, to get in the mix.
Gabriel wonders if individual banks will get enough cash at the end of the day to make a difference. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn. For Marketplace.
With the economy slimming down every day, you'd think Americans would be trimming their food budgets, too. And there is some evidence that's happening, at least at the high end of the food chain. Whole Foods is cutting back on expansion plans as it responds to a more frugal shopping public. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
When Whole Foods reports its quarterly earnings on Wednesday, analysts expect to see sales growth between 0 and 1%. A few years ago, sales were increasing in the double digits. Whole Foods has already cut back on plans to open new stores nationwide. That's not surprising with customers like Allison Lord. I met her outside the Whole Foods store in Portland.
I'm much more conscious of prices and price comparison and thinking, do I really need that item or not? Or can I make it work with something else?
which is not to say that consumers are ready to throw in the towel on organic food. What they are doing is buying in bulk from organic wholesalers or shopping more at Whole Foods competition, lower-cost local grocery chains, and food co-ops. Barth Anderson is a director at the Wedge Food Co-op in Minneapolis. He says business is up.
It's wonderful, actually. The downturn in the economy has really brought a lot of people home. They don't say, well, we're just going to order a pizza. They actually cook.
But will they keep buying more expensive organic ingredients to do that cooking? Sam Frommarts thinks they will. He's author of the book Organic Inc.
Consumers, you know, if they really believe in the value of organic foods, they're going to continue to buy it because it's what they're putting into their bodies. So they're going to cut back in other areas. They're going to try and get them for as cheap as they can.
Which means, says Frommarts, shopping more at mainstream groceries that have added organic lines like Safeway, Kroger, and Walmart. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This next item is going to resonate a little bit, seeing as how oil closed below $64 a barrel today. It wasn't so long ago that ethanol was being touted as a possible solution to the energy problem. And the government still does require states to add it to gasoline. But today, Goldman Sachs told clients that its analysts aren't going to analyze the industry anymore. That news comes on the heels of the largest publicly traded ethanol company in this country filing for bankruptcy. Of the handful of standalone ethanol companies that there are, shares of some of them are trading for as little as a dollar a share. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports now on why ethanol is in a pinch.
Goldman analysts didn't return our calls by deadline, but told clients today they believe the outlook for ethanol companies is challenged. The worst is Verisun, the company that filed for bankruptcy on Friday. Verisun produces about 7% of all U.S. ethanol made from corn. The company bet wrong on corn prices this summer, ag economist Chad Hart at Iowa State University.
They thought corn prices were going even higher, so they booked a lot of corn at that high price ahead of time. So they're still paying the prices we saw this summer, even though corn prices have dropped.
Prices dropped on better-than-expected harvests and falling energy costs, and falling oil prices have forced ethanol producers to cut their prices as well. The credit crunch isn't helping either. Dan Bossi, president of the research firm Ag Resource, says only the strongest will survive.
You're going to find consolidation in the industry, more capital still coming in, but it's going to be the older capital, the ADMs of the world, the Cargills, and others that are going to be picking up these firms that are too small and poorly capitalized. The firms will continue. It's just with another name on the front door.
Analysts say don't count corn ethanol out. Despite controversy over its eco-benefits, the federal ethanol mandate still exists and requires an increasing amount of the biofuel be produced in coming years. Republican John McCain has opposed that mandate, but Democrat Barack Obama has told farmers he's all for it. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
It was very, very calm on Wall Street today, despite some crummy economic indicators. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Shares of MasterCard lost nearly 4% today ahead of the release of its earnings report after the close, and indeed it swung to a loss last quarter. Profits are eroding as customer spending slows and the card companies collect less in fees. But MasterCard, Visa, and all the rest aren't actually all that eager for new business, as more and more Americans fail to make payments on things like houses, cars, and, yeah, their credit card bills. Those card companies are tightening up their standards, and that may be squeezing their profits. Rachel Dornhelm reports.
On paper, landscape designer David Searles looks like a great credit card customer. He's had one of his American Express cards for more than 10 years. He hasn't touched it in 9 months. He says he's never missed a payment on the card. He did push it to its limit last year, but paid off the balance quickly. Still, 6 weeks ago, Amex cut him off.
You can see zero balance, $500 available credit. That used to say $19,500 or somewhere in that area, give or take $1,000.
Searles thinks Amex is scared by statistics showing increasing numbers of Americans failing to make their interest payments.
And I think from their fear, they're throwing this blanket out over a bunch of us that they don't have any idea who or what is under the blanket.
Amex wouldn't talk on tape about any individual account. In an email, the company says it is being more targeted in response to economic conditions. It acknowledged more clients are having their credit lines cut as the company manages its risk. John Altsheimer is president of consumer education for Credit.com. He says credit card companies are increasing interest rates, too, and sometimes terminating accounts altogether.
My phone and my email at the end of the day let off a stream of smoke from the number of callers and emailers who are complaining about these types of activities.
He says it's not necessarily the cardholder's fault.
What we're trying to explain to people is this is really a product of the environment, not necessarily always a product of their credit.
He's talking about the worry that the credit card industry could melt down the way the mortgage business did. Remember those toxic bonds backed by home loans? Well, institutions have made bonds out of bundles of credit card loans, too. Greg Larkin is a senior analyst at Innovest Strategic Value Advisors. He says by the end of 2009, Americans will default on $96 billion of credit card debt. And those credit card-backed bonds will be worth a lot less.
By the time we know who invested in the securitized credit card portfolio, it'll be too late. Because the reason you'll know about who invested in it is because they say, we're announcing losses on credit card write-offs.
That $96 billion in credit card defaults doesn't come close to the $700 billion in home loans. But card companies want to stop the rot now. Clamping down on spending limits reduces their risk. But Larkin says it restricts consumers' ability to spend, and that could slow the country's recovery.
Historically, one way you deal with a recession is that people spend their way out of it. And so I think it's going to have a sort of multiplier effect that will make the recession worse and last longer.
Card companies know a recession will affect them, too, but they're still getting more conservative. John Altsheimer says the balance of power inside the credit card companies has shifted.
You really have two competing forces for control of the ship. You have the marketing people and you have the risk people.
In the past, he says marketers had the upper hand. Now, risk managers have taken the helm. In this climate, they want borrowers that are practically risk-free. Sticking to that kind of consumer will keep the company safer, but it won't make them nearly as much money. I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace.
We're not going to know who won the presidential election until tomorrow night sometime, that is, barring something unusual happening. But the free market can give us a pretty good idea of how things might wind up. People willing to put a few bucks on the line give us a sense of the odds in what are called the prediction markets. Justin Wolfers teaches at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also an occasional commentator for us. And David Leonhardt is a columnist at the New York Times. Hi, guys.
Hey, Kai. Hello, Kai.
Justin, let me start with you. Tell us your experience from election night 2006. You got a little story to tell.
Well, like everyone else, I was watching the major networks. The only thing I was doing a little bit differently was also tracking the prediction markets on Intrade.com. It actually turned out to be pretty important because around about midnight, most of the major networks were telling us it was a boring election. The Democrats weren't going to win the Senate, and my guests were about to get up and go home. At about that point, the prediction markets moved very, very sharply, suggesting something was up and the Democrats may well take the Senate. My guests decided to stay, have another drink, and it turned out we were drinking to a new Senate majority.
David, let me ask you this, though. Is that really to suggest that this offshore gambling company in Ireland knows better than all the collected wisdom of the pundits in the United States of America?
I think to some extent it does know better, and there are a couple of reasons for that. One, it's not just this one offshore betting company. There are a number of these markets, and usually the odds move together. The second thing is the pundits aren't actually being honest with viewers. They know a lot more than they're saying. Pundits don't like to talk in percentage terms. They don't like to say, at this point, it looks like there's a 70% chance that the Democrats are going to take over the Senate, and there's a 30% chance they won't. And a lot of us are comfortable with odds and like to hear those percent chances. And so in some ways, we can't get that from the TV. It's not that the people on TV don't have the information that these traders do.
Justin, you're a professional economist. You study these things for a living. How are these futures markets different than polls, which we've all seen ad infinitum the past couple of months?
Well, one important difference is that these ask you to put your money where your mouth is. Mm. It's not too hard to tell a pollster that you're cranky with the current set of politicians, but you may end up doing something very different in the privacy of the polling booth. I think the more important thing, though, is the question they ask. Polls ask you, who is it you intend to vote for? Here we're asking instead, who is it you think will win? And it may well be a better way of forecasting elections.
Kai, I think one of the really interesting things this year is going to be to compare the forecasting value of these prediction markets with the forecasting value of a website called 538.com, where a guy named Nate Silver is doing some really sophisticated analysis of polls. And the question is, are the traders any better at analyzing these polls than 538 is at doing data crunching from these polls? And so in some ways, 2008 is going to be a really interesting test for these prediction markets in a way that 2006 and 2004 was not.
David, we've talked about Intrade. We talked about 538.com. Where else would you suggest people look?
Well,
go ahead. Plug the New York Times. Go ahead.
Well, certainly I would encourage them to look at the New York Times. I would encourage them to look at all sorts of media sources. I think one of the keys here is that we are in an environment with massive amounts of information out there. What I like about these prediction markets is they're actually an attempt to synthesize all those sources out there. They're not perfect, but they're quite good.
Justin, last question to you. Polls close at 7 o'clock Eastern time tomorrow. Is that when we should start looking for some of this data?
You may even want to look a little earlier than that. Sometimes these markets give early signals. Sometimes, as we learned in 2004 with the funny business with the exit polls, they give false signals. But I think throughout the day, as you see things like weather, turnout in various states, and then later on as the exit polls start to hit the market, we'll see news all through the day.
Justin Wolfers at the University of Pennsylvania. David Leonhardt with the New York Times. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, business book publishers pine for a crystal ball.
Who would have thought that Iceland was the big problem of the world? Why Iceland?
But first, let's do the numbers. Not so much on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrial shaved off a tiny fraction of 1%, just 5 points, to close at 9,319. Biotech shares helped lift the NASDAQ 5 points, almost a third percent, ended at 1726. The S&P 500 whittled away 2 points, a quarter percent, wrapped up the trading day at 966. That plunge in auto sales, as I mentioned, the worst in almost a quarter century, renewed doubts about the survival of U.S. car makers. Stock in General Motors sputtered 2.5%. It's now down to just $5 and change, and a share of Ford Motor Company will get you around $2. It skidded another 2.75% today. Sliding oil prices led energy stocks lower. Halliburton, the country's second biggest provider of oil field services, dropped more than 7%. Chevron shares lost nearly 1.25% today. Bond prices were higher. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 3.91%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Cleveland Clinic, committed to providing health and wellness services through its executive health program at clevelandclinic.org/executive health. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The U.S. Commerce Department releases the September report on factory orders. The U.S. Supreme Court hears oral arguments in a case on obscenities in broadcast programming. And on Election Day, independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader will hold a news conference in Washington. He will issue only one-word answers to questions for the first 30 minutes. I'm Allison Gilbert.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The short list of critical problems the planet faces is fairly straightforward. War, famine and droughts, global warming, and toilets. Not among the usual suspects, but maybe they ought to be. Rose George writes about the dirty world of human waste and where it goes in her latest book, The Big Necessity. Rose, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You use the word sanitation in this book, and really that's a euphemism for a euphemism for a euphemism. Why is something that is so necessary in our lives and in our economy and in our health system and in everything so hard to talk about?
It hasn't always been that way. It's been a gradual process over the last 250 years or so. And it's really come about with the rise of the flush toilet. When it came into really common use in London in the 19th century, one in two children died from diarrhea and disease before the age of five, and afterwards mortality dropped by a fifth. So it's been an incredible invention, but one of the side effects of it is that it's brushed the issue of sanitation out of our public discourse. We don't have a neutral word for it.
When international organizations go out and give money and grants and development aid to developing countries, is it spent on the infrastructure needed for sanitation, or does that somehow wind up at the end of the distribution chain?
There is an expression in the world of development which is WATSAN. That stands for water and sanitation, and there's a reason it's not in alphabetical order, because the bulk of the funding and the attention that is given to water and sanitation goes to water. Water is easier to talk about. No one's going to be embarrassed to be photographed standing in front of a nice, clean and shiny tap gushing out life-saving water. But nobody wants to stand in front of a latrine, even though its public health benefits are actually greater than a simple water pipe. And this translates into a financial bias towards water.
Even though I'd imagine you can't really have substantial economic development without some treatment of sanitation, right?
Well, it's one of the most effective health preventions you can make, and the World Bank and the World Health Organization has calculated that if you invest a dollar in sanitation, then you reap $7 in health costs averted and in labor days that are gained. Your workers are not off sick from diarrhea. So it's extremely cost effective. It's actually a bargain.
So we here in America have excellent sanitation. Most of the developed world also has really good sanitation. What does that do, though? I mean, what are the costs of that? Obviously, we reap the benefits. What are the costs?
Well, the costs are a system that is arguably not particularly sustainable. It's expensive in terms of both money that needs to be spent on upgrading and maintaining these very large sewer systems and wastewater treatment plants. And on the other hand, it's also wasting water, which is an increasingly precious resource, even in the Western world, and certainly in many parts of the US. And so it's activists would say that people who want to look at the wastewater system again, who think it's, okay, it was a solution in the past, but it's in need of evolution.
What happens when you're at a cocktail party and somebody says to you, what do you do? And you say, oh, I'm writing a book on toilets around the world.
That's happened to me a lot over the last 3 years,
I
as
bet,
you can imagine.
Yeah.
There's generally a slight pause of bemusement. And then suddenly, as if a tap has switched on and all these stories come pouring out, everybody's got a toilet anecdote. And that's perfectly understandable because we spend a lot of our life in the bathroom. Someone has calculated that we spend 3 years of our life in the bathroom. So that's a lot of thinking time.
The book by Rose George about sanitation and all that word implies is called The Big Necessity. Rose, thanks a lot for your time.
You're welcome.
A friend in Germany sent a note this morning, which I figured we ought to pass on. It seems Das Kapital, the classic from Karl Marx, is selling more copies since the global economy went kaput, 8 times its usual rate of about 200 a year. Publishers of business texts all over must be pleased to hear financial fare is still popular, because warehouses are full of books explaining how to get an edge in the markets, the ones from before the financial crisis, that is. But Sally Herships reports now from New York that with a few nips and tucks, they could still make it to store shelves.
Times like this, Philip Ruppel wishes he had a magic wand. He publishes business books for McGraw-Hill Professional. He values a timely title, one that's on top of the news, something that's been close to impossible recently. For example,
who would have thought that Iceland was the big problem of the world? Why Iceland?
Ruppel can console himself with the fact that Iceland's collapse wasn't on anyone's radar until a couple of months ago. It takes at least that long just to get a book written.
It can take a year. The Great American Novel can take 10 years. And that's not the controllable part of the process. It's as long as it takes to write the words. I've always said you can't publish a book without the words in it.
And then there's editing, printing, proofing. Typically, production takes 8 to 9 months. Peter Knapp works at Wiley, another business publisher. He says making a book that was written a year ago relevant to the public is something of an art.
A few adjustments can actually make a big difference in how a book is perceived and how timely it seems.
Knapp is working on a book which, until recently, was titled Contagion, The Coming Crash of the Global Markets.
It's actually going to be called now Contagion, The Financial Epidemic That Is Sweeping the Global Economy.
Marketing magic. Change the title, change perceptions. This alchemy isn't confined to new books. It can turn back titles into gold as well. Philip Ruppel again.
I don't think there's a publisher in New York City who is not going into their deep backlist saying, what was the book that I published 5 years ago, 4 years ago, that maybe is relevant today and that we should be looking at and maybe updating it for today's market to make it even more relevant?
Basically, I'm recession-proofing my books, if that's a good way to look at it.
Doris Michaels is a literary agent. One of her books, called Rain, is about a paperboy who worked his way up to become a corporate rainmaker in the boom times. In marketing it, she's given it a twist.
Now, the way you can look at how to become a rainmaker is you want to make the most of what you have, making sure that your customers were happy and making sure that you're getting the business done.
But repackaging can't save every book. When the e-commerce bubble burst, no one would touch a book about e-anything. McGraw-Hill's Ruppel says the same thing happened to books on real estate when that market went south. To avoid being saddled with books that miss a trend, publishers hustle to get books published within months, chapters written within weeks. In this business, that's like breaking the sound barrier. There's even a name for it, crashing. And Wiley's Peter Knapp says publishers better get used to it.
This is the new normal. I don't anticipate that this is going to go away. Whatever the next cycle is, we're going to continually need to accelerate our response to market conditions and what people want.
And people appear to want business books, which still hold an 8% share of the book market, despite the downturn. But McGraw-Hill's Ruppel says tastes are changing again. Instead of volumes on finance and investing, he's looking for books on finding new jobs. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, you remember Senator Ted Stevens' trial a week or so ago? The Alaska Republican was convicted of lying on disclosure forms. Not long after the jury got the case, though, one of the jurors simply disappeared. She was eventually replaced after telling the judge that her father had died. Today, though, she was back in court to fess up. It seems juror number 4 had a date at a racetrack. She took off to be at the Breeders' Cup out here in California. The filly Goldikova won the Breeders' Cup mile, paid $5.60 to win. No word on where that juror had her money or what is eventually going to happen to her. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 5 points. That's a tiny fraction of 1%. The Nasdaq rose 5 points. That is a third of a percent. The S&P 500 fell 2 points, a quarter percent there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the broadcast, when staying healthy seems like a luxury.
Certainly, it's, you know, more comfortable to not have heartburn, but the co-payments for some of those medications are pretty high, and we just don't have the money in our budget to do that.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.